go ahead and turn the meeting back over to Dave.
Okay. All right. So, talking about what convinces us to the point of making this decision about our relationship with God and making a commitment towards it. There's about five requirements to the third step prior to making the decision or the prayer. We know this because it says so. Unless you choose not to see it. So at the bottom of page 60, it says, being convinced we are at step 3. The next paragraph says, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. And that's a very important part of that principle to understand. I don't see anybody in here that's cruel. You may have been cruel. But I think that when it comes to the solution to the problems in our life surrounding alcohol, I think we've all wanted them to be better. But the book's saying that even though our motives are right, if it doesn't have the right power behind it, it's going to end up in failure. And you're not going to know that by just saying, I'm powerless over alcohol, my life's unmanageable, check. Came to believe in the power of myself, restoring the sanity, check, and moving on to the third step. It's not going to have any teeth. You've got to get this hooked into yourself and see where this really has legitimacy and really and get it really an experience. Or else it's just going through the motions. Okay? So where are the other ones at? So the other ones are, I'm just going to point out a few, is there's only a few. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. That's two right there. That's a total of three so far. I have to be convinced of that. I have to be convinced that selfishness can take me out of here even without a drink of alcohol. And I also have to be convinced that it's going to require a higher power, relationship with a higher power, in order for that to happen. I also have to be convinced that a little bit of selfishness is not okay. Okay? Again, my dealer's broken, my coper's broken, my reliever's got a bad arm. Okay? This is very simple. I have been out of control with alcohol since I was 15. The degree of alcoholism, which is what I'm left with, which is a life that's rooted in selfishness and self-centeredness, was not the same at the end as it was in the beginning. When I was 16 years old, I was the kid that everybody wanted to come over and be friends with their kid. But when I was 18, I was lower companionship. I wasn't seeking lower companionship. I was lower companionship. Okay? I wasn't raised that way at all. Okay? My degree of selfishness, self-centeredness, dishonesty, and fear progressed just as my drinking progressed. So I come into recovery. Yip, yip, hooray. Right? Sober. Start going in a positive direction. And so the selfishness and self-centeredness and dishonesty starts smoothing out. Starts getting back to the way it was. Right? And then I forget that I'm still just as powerless as I was before, and just because I'm over on this side with recovery doesn't mean that the intensity and the acuteness of my alcoholism, even though it has dissipated and reduced, doesn't mean it's less dangerous. So it's no comfortable place for me to look in the mirror and say, oh, well, I'm not as dishonest as I used to be. Or I'm not as selfish as I used to be. I'm not as self-centered as I used to be. That is no place of comfort for me. Because I don't know how much any of that stuff takes to block me off from the sunlight of the Spirit. I have no clue. Okay? Because I drink under all conditions. Why do I take the first drink? I don't know. And so that's why it terrifies me sometimes when I hear people talking about their experience with selfish and self-centeredness, like they know the line of where, oh, now I got to go to God. I'm glad you're so clear. I'm not. And I don't even want that responsibility, and I don't have to have that responsibility. I can check it all in. God's big enough to handle it all. He doesn't need me to come in there and break it up into little piles of selfishness and little piles of dishonesty, and then give it to him on a wheelbarrow. He doesn't need that. He can take them as they are, the way they are, as big as they are. Okay? He doesn't need me getting in there and chopping it all up. We just take it all. That's what infinite has to do with, right? I can't wrap myself around infinite. My finite mind cannot wrap myself around the infinite. What I can wrap it around is that it's bigger than my stuff. It's big enough to handle my stuff. Okay? So the fallacy, the spiritual fallacy in getting in there and working on it and just settling for relief from and dealing with and coping with is that it's still there. It's still present. And I don't know how much of that being present it takes to drinking again or just straight blowing my brains out. I just don't know where that is. Okay? You can do what you want. Keep messing around with that stuff. Personally, I don't want to mess with it. And let's get a definition about removal that has been taken a beating in AA for as long as I've been here. Okay? If you look in the 1939 dictionary about removal, there's a couple different definitions. One is removal, gone, disappear. Okay? The key prefix is re. There's also the removal that you can move it out of the way, but it also can be removed back. Okay? That's the kind of removal that we work with. That's right. God can move this out of the way for the sunlight of His Spirit, but we can become self-reliant and watch this stuff be removed right back in the way, or not see it. Because every relapse that's talked about in the early part of the book occurred suddenly at times when they weren't expecting. You know, this is one of the things that I hear a lot too is people telling other people that relapse that, oh yeah, you were setting yourself up. We could tell. Look, if I don't know what the day is going to look like when I drink, you don't either. And any idea that you think you know what the day is going to look like when I'm going to drink is preposterous. And that's me putting reliance on you instead of a higher power. I've been averaging 2 meetings a week at best for the last 10 years. And I have had countless people come up to me and tell me, you're going to drink. And I've told them, well, you better tell God because He doesn't know about that program. Okay? It's not on purpose. It's not by accident. It's just the way it is right now, practicing these principles in all my affairs, because they're just as much about God's will as being involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, you can play the game with that stuff if you want to. It's deadly. So what's a recovered alcoholic look like? Alcoholism is what we're left with. when we're not drinking, and it demands to be treated, and we're talking about the treatment. Even friends that I'm closest with will pull up short that we can be recovered spiritually. But our book is very clear that we can straighten out spiritually. Alcoholism is our term for a spiritual sickness. Okay? It might be overeating for somebody else. It might be narcissism for somebody else. It might be PTSD for somebody else. Okay? But for us, it's called alcoholism. That's what we give the name of spiritual malady. That's the name of our spiritual malady. And that is, like it's described, selfishness and self-centeredness. Rooted in selfishness and self-centeredness, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. So what does a recovered condition look like? Let me offer you what that looks like. To me. It's a life that's rooted. Remember when Bill talks about Eddie and his feet grasp new soil? He said it wasn't like his life was just rearranged. His feet were grasping new soil. Okay? So maybe it's a life that's rooted in being God-centered and unselfish rather than rooted in selfishness and self-centeredness. Maybe it's a life that's being guided by faith and courage rather than 100 forms of fear. Maybe it's a life that's being guided by being God-seeking rather than self-seeking. All right. Maybe it's a life that's guided by being honest and true, honest and the truth, rather than self-delusion. Maybe it's a life that's being guided by being happy, joyous, and free, rather than self-pity. It doesn't mean that they're absent, but there's a hell of a difference between being driven by and falling short. That's why we have a step 11 and a step 10 for when we fall short. But there's a difference. Like, I know what it's like to be driven by. I've been in the back of a cop car.
Mm-hmm.
When you get out, when they say you get out, that's when you get out. That's being driven by. And I have lived under the lash of the spiritual malady, alcoholism, drunk or sober, under those conditions. That's what brought me back to the steps. I was 6-7 years sober, pounding my head up against AA, like page 44, 45 talks about, and couldn't figure out why I was just getting more and more miserable. You know? Self-willing, a spiritual program. Okay? So, there's a couple more requirements. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying on our own power. We had to have God's help. This is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided the hereafter in the drama of life, God was going to be our director. And it talks about the other two relationships. So there's actually five requirements before making the decision and making a commitment to the third step. So you make the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. That's it. That's the first part. Not part of you. Not this part, that part. But you're willing to say, okay, God, here I am. Blank check. You do with me what you want. As much as I want to try and give him change orders, right, and blueprints on how to do it differently, right, I made a commitment to say, no, you're going to direct my life. This is giving back the gift of free will. This is what we're doing. We're saying this gift of free will that you've given every human being, I just seem to do the wrong things with. And I hurt people, including myself. And I don't want it anymore. I just want to live under your guidance, your will. Am I willing to give up such a gift? That's the ultimate gift. Am I willing to do that and trust it? Right? Leave me the bonds of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. That sounds like the best part, right? Until you read what it's for. Take away difficulties for this purpose, right? We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. We don't know what utterly is. Again, that's like infinite, right? Trying to wrap the finite around the infinite. But you can find out what it's not once you start writing inventory and you say, that's enough of that. I'm willing to write this, but I don't want to write that. Right? This is too painful. This is too hard. Whatever might comes up that separates us from continuing on this path, then you find out what utterly isn't. Okay. And then it says we launched into an inventory. And that if we don't launch into this inventory, our decision, everything up to this point, is not going to spell permanent recovery. So if I'm not jumping into inventory after a third step, I have to look at myself in the mirror. A, do I really want permanent recovery? Is that really on the agenda? Or do I still have some lurking notion about drinking again? Or do I still think I have a third alternative? That I still think I can pull off being sober my way? Okay? And the book talks about that this inventory is about the fact-facing process, right? That we are to get the things in the way that are blocking us off from God. It's not about understanding ourselves better. It's not supposed to be a therapeutic process based in finding out all my triggers and what makes me tick. We don't want that anyway. Starting with Bill, all the way through all the little stories up until this point, every single one of them describe having understood themselves better as a result of either talking to a high-powered psychiatrist, AAs, well, it would have been Oxford Groupers at that point, but in any event, sober alcoholics that were living a spiritual life, or a combination of both. And they all understood themselves better, and they all drank again. Step four is about understanding God better. And we can only do that by getting this stuff out of the way. A strenuous effort, right? That's what it says. A strenuous effort to have the things removed that are blocking us off from God. Resentment towards people, institutions, and principles. People are pretty easy. Institutions are pretty easy, right? Like the IRS comes to mind. United States Marine Corps comes to mind. That's right, court systems. AA is an institution. Ethnicities. It's all very easy. Marriage as an institution, which I have no experience with. But principles are a little vague in AA, and you'd be hard-pressed to find people that know how to list principles. And we don't have time to get into the long thing about this, but principles are simply belief systems that I guide my life by. Most of them are self-sabotaging. Ideas about myself that have been ingrained in me since I can remember. I'm no good. I'm stupid. I'm unlovable. I'm inadequate. I'm not good enough. I'm empty. I'm worthless. Walking around with a bunch of nonsense in my head that I've had in my head for so long that it's sacrosanct, unchallengeable. But it's there. And I take it into every walk of life. So I know, and because of these belief systems that I have that I don't like about myself, that I carry with me everywhere I go, I end up resentments with you and institutions. My first inventory, there's 125 people, probably a couple dozen institutions, and very little principles, because even my sponsor really wasn't sure how to convey principles to an inventory at the time. Keep up with a few, like no matter what you do in life, no matter how good you do in life, you're always going to get screwed. God rewards those who have faith in Him. That never seemed to be true. But there were some simple ones in the very beginning that my sponsor helped me pull out that were crippling me. And so we get all that on paper. And you just go to the next thing. The next thing is why. How did it affect me? Now I look at that from a couple different places. Not just why was I angry or why was I resentful. The book talks about three other terms: hurt, threatened, interfered with. Okay? So when I'm looking at the second column on how was I affected, I'm thinking about those three terms as well: hurt, threatened, interfered with. And with guys, like if you use the word resentment, most of them will say, oh, I'm not resentful of anything. Right? You don't get this with women, but you get it with guys. Right? Right? But if you just say, well, why don't you just write a list of people that have aggravated you? Then all of a sudden their list looks like everybody else's. Or why don't you just write a list of people that interfere with you? Now you got every license plate number on 99. Right? So now their list looks like everybody else's. And so then we get into the third list, which is looking at the areas of self that have been affected. The book talks about eight. Self-esteem, which is how I see myself. Pride, which is how I want others to see me. There is ambitions, what I want in order to be okay. Security, what I think I need to be okay, which I get crossed up all the time. Personal relationships, how I think they should be. Sex relations, how I think, which is, back at sex relations, which I wasn't taught this in the beginning, but I was taught this later, was really about how, as a gender, how I should be as a man or as a boy should be in a particular relation. Not like how am I supposed to respond as a man, right? Not as a sexual, how it affected sex relations that are intimate. That would come later in the sex inventory. What did I say? Pocketbooks. What did I pay with? You know, how did it affect my pocketbook? I was taught that not to just look at money, that I pay with a lot of other things. I pay with time, energy, emotions, all kinds of stuff. Right? I was to, and then, like the example shows, fear. Okay? Now, after doing this a couple times, and sponsoring some guys doing it a couple times, one of the things that became apparent is that when it came to time to actually fifth step, that we didn't remember what we were thinking about when we wrote just the word self-esteem as being affected. We didn't remember why our pride was affected. We just wrote the word and came to fifth step time, and now you can't really remember. And now you go from something that should only take about 2 hours to about 10 hours. Okay? And so it was impressed upon me by a sponsor just make a note about how my self-esteem was affected, how my pride was affected, so that I know the book doesn't say it. I know that. Okay? But this just came from guys that have been doing it for decades and said, that'll help us fifth step better. And so it reduced the time. It also help with clarity, right? Because the information was there. It wasn't designed to make my life miserable and more work. It actually was less work in the, on the back end. It's also good to see the difference, what I'm writing with relation to security and ambitions, because that's where I really start to find out that I can't differentiate the true from the false in a lot of things, not just alcohol. And that a lot of the things that I want, I don't need, and the things I think I need, you know, I don't want. Right? So it was good in that respect. But ultimately, it woke me up to these areas of self and realizing that my self-esteem, my pride, my personal relations, what I want, my ambitions, my security, were all based on my ideas. And none of it was true. That everything I wrote in the third column was basically a lie to myself. And so when we started going through it, I was to look at self-esteem, which is how I see myself, rather than how I being so wrapped up in how I see myself, but consider how God wants me to see me. When it came to pride, and I'm so wrapped up on how I think you should see me, get more interested in actually how God sees me. Have I ever been as worried and consumed with that as I have how you see me? Right? Ambitions. Rather than being so wrapped up in what I want, what does God want? And we change the word from ambition to aspiration, which the root is in spirit, right? This is a little twist of word changes the attitude, okay? What I need is God knows what I need, and I've ever asked. And if I asked, have I listened? And when I listened, did I follow through? Okay? I don't believe that the things in the third column are things that I want back. I believe they're the things that I need to look at from God's perspective rather than my perspective. Okay? How does God want that relationship that I'm in? Father, son, son, father. And I'm talking about my son. Employer, employee. Sponsor, sponsee. You name it. Okay? How does God want that relationship to look? How does he want me to respond as a man in this with this person, that relationship, that other, this relationship. How does he want me to respond as a man instead of just getting a 45 out and handling? Okay? Am I willing to seek God as a resource instead of being so caught up in what I think I'm paying with to keep this relationship going with this person that's in the first column? Right? I'm going to run out of love. I'm going to run out of friendship. I'm going to run out of tolerance. I'm going to run out of patience. But God isn't. Okay? God doesn't love me for who I am. God loves me for who he is. Okay? And so then there's this transition from the third list to the fourth list that talks about seeing two basic things. There's a bunch of things it says just to see, but it wants you to see two things. One is that the first, second, and third column represent me trying to have my own way, me playing God. It also wants me to see that I put you in the position to play God for me, to pull off what I can't pull off, to pull off what God can't pull off, to validate how I see myself, to validate how I want you to see me, to validate how I'm supposed to be as a man, to validate that what I want and what I need is correct. Okay? And that I'm putting that responsibility on you. I'm playing God by making you God in my life. It's really manipulative. And then it wants me to see that, to look at it from an entirely different angle. And that is, have I done, or have I thought, or have I said, the thing I wrote in step two, why I'm hurt, why I'm resentful, to that person or anybody else in my life? And you know what's going to come up? It's a big fat yes. And the book says, am I willing to consider that that person is perhaps spiritually sick also like I am? Not like I'm up here and I'm now elevated because I'm in AA and I'm in spiritual kindergarten, right? I just learned how to pray yesterday, right? But that we are on equal ground here. And that, like myself, that they are spiritually sick too. And if I didn't have the power or the wherewithal to do anything different than I did, that they didn't either. And that levels it out. And what that brings about is a sense of forgiveness that I couldn't produce on my own. I wasn't raised that way. I was raised in a good church, being groomed to be a full-blown missionary by the time I was 18. I went to seminary for 4 years in high school. I wasn't raised this way. But this is the way I became. This is what I became. Okay? And so the whole idea of wanting to forgive, I mean, I wasn't raised to hate my parents. I wasn't raised to hate everybody I met in school. I wasn't raised that way. Okay? But that's, when I came to AA, I was a hater. In fact, that's what they used to call me when they, in Hawaii, right? Oh, here comes Hateful because he's never grateful. Right? They used to call me the little ball, they used to call me the little ball of hate.
Little ball of hate.
Right? You know, here he comes, little ball of hate. You going to me? Right? Fuck you. Yeah. True story. We'll get off just for a second before we get into fear. So when I came to AA, I didn't have a love fest with the fellowship, okay? I'll just be straight with you. Okay? And I saw you as a whole group of people I hadn't got a chance to hate yet. So I started hating on you right away to make up for lost time. And so my sponsor thought it'd be a great idea to put one of these under my arm, show up 30 minutes early to shake hands and give hugs to people I could not stand. And I did that, right? And he said it would get me out of myself and stop thinking about my knee all the time. And it did. It just got me to hate you more. Right? You approach the guys that don't give a crap, right? Oh, yeah. Oh, you got that duty too, like that. And then you get the ladies that come up that have their sponsor that told them, oh, no hugs with men. No hugs with men. I can't even shake your hand, the sponsor says. It's like, ooh, what program is that one, you know? You want a relapse? I mean...
She's not kidding.
So I was told by my sponsor that I couldn't talk to any newcomers unsupervised. And the fact that you have me sitting up here for 5 hours is absolutely hysterical. So anyway, so let's talk about fear, or the fourth column. So you go into the fourth column, and so I have this sense of forgiveness that I can never bring about on my own. It allows me to have enough clarity to actually look at myself without any regard for you other than how I hurt you, right? The book is very clear. There's nothing, there's no zero instruction in the fourth column of our resentment inventory that says anything about my part. I'm not going to do a whole other dissertation on that. Only to say, if I'm still looking at my part, then I haven't been I'm not free of their part, which is right, same principle as working on my selfishness, working on my self-centeredness. There's still a part. And I don't know how much of that part of the resentment I can hold on to before it destroys me. Resentment destroys more alcoholics than anything else. But I'm going to hold on to my part. It's a mindset. The book says that they should be resolutely out of the picture on this part of the inventory. They shouldn't be a consideration other than how is I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid. Period. Okay, that's it. And just disregard their involvement entirely is the word. Thank you. So that doesn't leave any room for my part, nor should it. Or why would I want to? Do I want to be free or not? Or do I just want relief? Because if I just want relief, it's just going to get, like I said, shorter, shorter, shorter. Okay? Selfishness is very simple. It's mine, and you're not getting it over my dead body. And that can be physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. I can withhold love. I can withhold ideas. I can withhold interaction. I can withhold money. I can withhold the truth. All of that. Okay? What's self-seeking? You got it, and I'm going to take it over your dead body. Okay? And that can be, again, physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually. Honesty. I work with three different types of dishonesty. One is, most important, self-delusion. What am I lying to myself about that perpetuates these ideas of, that are presented in these eight areas in the third column? What are the lies that are tied up in having to see myself in this way, needing you to see me in a certain way, that drive me to believe that I need this and I want that? What lie am I telling myself that's driving all of that? Okay? Then there's the lies of commission. I have to see where, what have I said or what have I done that's been dishonest that actually harmed that person? Right? In order to get this validation of all these ideas in the third column. And then another one we talk about is omission. The dishonesty that we lie by not saying anything. What is the truth that I'm suppressing? See, in order for me to live by a self-delusion, I have to express the lie. I have to live in the lie. In order to live in the lie, I have to suppress the truth. The truth is what I omit. What's the truth? Right? What's the truth that I've omitted? And then fear. Fear is not just repetitive of what I bracketed in the third column. It's asking what fear, you know, what was the fear behind the resentment towards this person? It's very simple. Very short. It can be long, but it's all very short stuff. We don't need a life story. Okay? And what you come to find out is fear is the driving factor in all of it, which is the next part of the inventory. It isn't like three ways to do inventory. It's an inventory that goes deeper, deeper, deeper. Resentment, then the fear, then the sex conduct. Okay? So you start in on a list for fear. Your list carries over from your fourth column of your resentment. You may have some other fears that are not tied to resentment at all. Get that on paper. The book's going to say, why do you have the fear? Was it because self-reliance failed? Okay? Well, if you have fear, and on that same inventory you had selfish and self-seeking, then self-reliance failed, right? Sometimes it's good to find out what forms of self-reliance you're relying on, what forms of self you're relying on. The book gives an example of self-confidence. Self-confidence being great or being good, but it didn't solve the fear problem. And I think that's a great example, because I think most of us were probably raised that self-confidence is good. I was. But when it came down to crunch time on a spiritual basis of life, it didn't mean anything. Okay? And so we can also rely on other different kinds of self that are presented in the book. We can rely on self-knowledge, self-justification, self-importance, self-seeking, self-will, self-love. It's not in the book, but yes, self-love. Love me until you can love yourself or whatever. That's all right. You can save that for somebody else. It kills me. How can I know how I need to be loved better than God does? Or in the way I need to be loved, okay? Better than God does. I don't. And what we come to find out is that when we do that, we look at all these different forms of self that we've used to overcome the fear problem, and it hasn't, and it's perpetuated the fear. It gives the next statement very true, because it's chief, in that we had to stop relying on the finite God, our finite selves, and begin to rely on an infinite God. Okay, it's going to talk about faith means courage, that our fear was about a lack of faith. So sometimes it's good to look at, where did I lack faith that drove the fear? Where did I lack faith in God that drove the fear? And I'm not a person that believes that fear or faith, like fear cancels out faith and faith cancels out fear, like you can't have both in the same room. Anybody that's actually done any amends knows that's not true.
You got me wrong.
I mean, if you've done and made amends, you definitely can have fear and faith in the same room. And I can't make myself more faithful. I can't do it upon myself. I cannot make myself overcome that kind of fear.
Well, I have a question. You
kind of
brought this up, but I
think
you were asking, well, it says we think fear ought to be classed, but it seems to cause more trouble. And it went on for like 40 minutes, and at the end of our
meeting... Why don't you shoot him?
Yeah, but after the meeting, I was sitting in a quiet time, and I talked to him after the meeting about how, just giving an example, I had a fear that this girlfriend I had was going to leave me, so I started going through her phone and looking through her phone. And when I went to tell her, to be honest with her about doing that, she caught me, and I did admit it. So when I finally fessed up to her, she said, well, now I can't leave my phone on. And I've given an example that my fear of her leaving me caused me to take from her security about her phone. So in that way, it did do more than just taking her phone.
Mm-hmm. You got a question, Bobby? Or statement? I'm sitting here spending 5 hours as answer man, so I was waiting for a question.
Well, what's your experience with that,
man? Okay. Thank you. My need to be answer man. So I've heard all kinds of stuff about that particular line. The one that I almost grabbed onto was that this book was not written for kleptomaniacs. This book was written for alcoholics, and that the relation of fear to stealing is that we're making a choice about our fear, which I don't agree with. If that was the case, then fear is the overwhelming power here. It's stronger than the self-centeredness, it's stronger than the selfishness, so then I could just, if I could choose my way out of fear, I would, right? Mm-hmm. What I believe about that line is that fear is classed with stealing, in the fact that fear will rob you of everything that's important to you in your life. And if everything that is worthwhile to you in life, fear will rob it from you, mm-hmm. inwardly and outwardly. I am living proof that in sobriety that you can take your life apart brick by brick in the middle of this program because of fear, paralyzing fear, and not even feel it. Because you go beyond acceptance as the answer to all your problems. You go beyond apathy and depression. You go into a place of sloth, fear and paralyzing sloth. And you just wake up to it. I mean, you're wishing for depression at that point, because at least you're feeling something. But fear will rob you of everything that's important, everything that's worthwhile to you. And that, equating fear with stealing in that respect, I think is completely accurate and consistent with the book. So, the prayer. We're left with the prayer. So what we do with these fears, so you're going to have like 100 fears, right? Nobody ever believes that until they actually do it. But really, a lot of them are just repetitive and just worded differently, and you can whittle those down, and you should whittle those down to some core fears. Fear of dying, fear of drinking, fear of being unlovable. I'm just giving some examples. It can be a lot of other stuff. Fear of the unknown, But in any event, so we bring those to the table. We do this as an exercise, as another column for fear. And in each of those core fears, the prayer and the answer is simple. We do this pen in hand. God, remove my fear of being unlovable. What would you have me be? And just write it down. We don't edit it. We don't second guess it. We don't question it. We just trust. Okay? And this isn't going to be the first time we've done this. We'll have done this with the developments in the first step. We'll have done this with the God idea in the second step. We'll have done this with ideas about God that, all the stuff about God that we've avoided, ignored, had doubts about. We'll do that. I do this stuff written. Newcomers, old-timers, it doesn't matter to me. Okay? It just helps in getting clear. The extra 5-10 minutes it takes to write it is worth, it's just priceless to when you're actually trying to work with somebody. So we do the prayer. You can actually come here in Alcoholics Anonymous and find out what God would have you be. To your deepest, darkest fears. You can't get that from therapy. I am a product of failed therapy. When I got to the psych ward, they treated me for everything, including alcoholism. Type 2 sociopath. Okay? Lockdown. PTSD. Treated me for inner child, lost child, only child, whatever. Okay? See, one of the things that we have to understand, and the book speaks to this, is that the spiritual malady will mask itself as mental and emotional disorders. But you don't really know if they are mental and emotional disorders until you get treated spiritually. People might want to throw out really fast about the book referencing go out and seek a good doctor. And you should. But the part they forget is the stuff before it. And that is a spiritual way of life being the most powerful healing something, paraphrasing. And the spiritual treatment is our steps. Go through the first 9 steps. Get free of your 8-step list and come to me and see if any of that stuff is still there. Okay? But until that's done, we don't know. We don't know. Either I didn't have the psychological problems they said I did, because I failed the psychological method, or I did and the power of God straightened it out. I don't know. They told me that just doing this program and just going and getting involved in AA, having a relationship with God wasn't going to be enough. That's what I was told by my psychiatrist. And this is just me. All I've ever done since May 9th, 1993 is this book, Relationship with God, and that's it. I was either crazy or had a spiritual malady that was driving me to be crazy. Okay.
1 minute. 2 minutes.
2 minutes. All right. So, what would you have me be? Why? Well, the answer is going to be in the solution of the sex conduct inventory. What God would have me be, which is the last question of the sex conduct inventory, is who God wants me to be when I'm standing in front of you. The sex conduct inventory, I was taught, wasn't just about those I have intimate relationships with or had intimate relationships with. That I could use that with any relationship, and that I should. Okay? And simply, we answer the 9 questions. Selfish, dishonest, inconsiderate. Where I arouse jealousy, suspicion, and bitterness. Have I hurt others? Look around the relationship, not just Teddy. Okay? Look around the relationship. Were there other people involved? Okay? And the final question is, what should I have done instead? Which is the question that's posed to God, this new relationship you're going to have with God, and what's your ideal for my future sex life? What's your ideal for my relationship with my son, my mom, my dad, so I can be who God wants me to be when I'm standing in front of Him. Okay? One of the things that I do is after I do the fear exercise and I have the answers to what God would have me be, I put on a little 3x5 card, I stick it in the 11-step part of my book. Once a week or so, I recommit to that. I do the same thing with the right ideals for my future sex life or relationships. The answers are usually all very similar. So I have that on a 3x5 card, and I have it in the 11-step part of my book, so I recommit to it on a regular basis during my 11 steps. So that's just what I do with that stuff. And we'll take a break.